What makes the most recent American war novel to come out different from its predecessors? Tom Bissa will tell us about Green on Blue, a novel by Elliot Ackerman, which he reviews this week.
One of the really interesting lines in the book is Aziz's realization that the war has no sides, that it's just a bunch of people fighting for some incredibly nebulous end.
And what makes the Italians so Italian? We'll find out from John Hooper, here to talk about his new book, The Italians.
One of the other paradoxes about Italians is that they are warm, extrovert, but not spontaneous.
Alexander Alter will be here with Notes from the Publishing World, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Tom Bissa joins us now. He reviewed in this week's issue of the Book Review a new novel, a first novel by Elliot Ackerman called Green on Blue. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Pamela.
So this novel is part of a big wave of kind of post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan, although I'm not sure post actually is the right word, maybe mid-post Afghanistan and Iraq novels that have come out in recent years. Where does this one fit in?
Well, Ackerman's book is very unusual, both of the Iraq-Afghanistan batch of novels and in, I think, American literature itself, in that it's the only novel I can think of about an ongoing war told from the perspective of the enemy. And I'm going to put enemy in air quotes there because the main character, Aziz, like a lot of Afghans, has a pretty shadowy relationship to the various sides of the war. And, of course, one of the really interesting lines in the book is Aziz's realization that the war has no sides, that it's just a bunch of people fighting for some incredibly nebulous end. But Ackerman really tried to dive deep into the mind of someone who would find himself fighting for and against Americans at various times in the novel. And from that perspective, I really don't know anything else like it. And I'm very curious to see what kind of reception it's going to get from, you know, shall we say, our literary right wing.
Well, what kind of reception does it get from your wing?
I really enjoyed it a lot. I write in my review how I started out reading it and sort of not liking it because it didn't have the sort of absurdist humor that I'd just come to expect from, you know, the contemporary American war novel. Like even something like Matterhorn, which came out a few years ago, and which is a book that I absolutely love, had that kind of baseline catch-22 absurdist energy in it, because I think it's the only way for an educated person to process the, you know, immense psychic break of the war can put a human mind through. But this book's very different. Its approach to the war is really straight-faced and really somber, and I sort of missed humor and absurdism at first, and I was kind of not liking the book. But then I realized that that kind of perception of the war would have, you know, really no hold on the mind of someone like Aziz. And once I grasped that I was looking for something that it was literally not possible to be in there because it was told from a certain perspective, that I really began to see what Ackerman was up to, and I really, really responded to it.
I want to go back to this idea of humor in war novels, because when we think of Slaughterhouse-Five and Catch-22, these kind of two iconic World War II novels, there's so much humor in them. With Vietnam novels, there wasn't as much humor, nor was there really with World War I.
Not a really funny war, World War
I. No. Although, was World War II very humorous? I don't know.
Well, even The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien, which I don't think anyone would call that a funny book, there's some definite absurdist sort of elements in it. And I'm thinking of particularly the guy who said he steps on a landmine and his remains get flung up into a tree and all his comrades have to stand there and look up at him. I mean, those kinds of images that are sort of nightmarishly comic, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And going after Cachado, which is, you know, that fantasia that O'Brien wrote where the soldiers walk from Vietnam to, I think, Persia. I talked about the psychic break that war puts people through. And I wrote a book about the Vietnam War, about my dad's and my trip there. And one of the epigraphs I used for one of the chapters was something Richard Kapuscinski said, which is, you know, a person who has been through a war is unlike person who has never been through any war. They are not the same species of person.
We should mention that the author, Elliot Ackerman of Green on Blue, is also a war vet. How does his experience inform the novel?
Elliot Elliot Ackerman is a five-time vet. He had five tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was pretty highly decorated. He was the lieutenant of a combat infantry unit.
And recipient of a Purple Heart.
Recipient of a Purple Heart and a Silver Star, so he was decorated for bravery and gallantry. And it's really very rare to see a soldier, even a sensitive one, to go through what he must have gone through and come out of the war with wanting a deeper understanding of people that he'd fought for and against. And if you look at something like Chris Kyle's book, the American Sniper book, which you just read in an increasing state of shock at that, apparently that this guy who just harbored no hesitation and not a single bit of doubt that everyone he'd killed were either animals or savages or evildoers. And I think, Kyle arrived at that position just for the sake of his own sanity, to sort of reckon with what he'd done and all the people he had killed. I think he needed that assurance. But Ackerman did something like way braver than that, which was to actually think about, people on the other side of his barrel and his patrols and his sweeps. And it's a really moving thing that he's done. And I think if more writers did it from all sides of a war, I think there'd be a lot fewer wars, which is something I say in the review.
It's not a work of nonfiction. It is a novel. What is the plot of the novel, and who is this protagonist, Aziz?
Aziz is a young man who his parents are killed by militants, Afghan militants or jihadist militants, and he and his brother sort of try to get work in a sort of mid-sized Afghan city, and his brother is pretty gravely wounded, really horrifically wounded, actually, and to keep him put up in a well-attended hospital, Aziz starts working for one of a number of really shadowy handlers, guys who really make the war run, whether by, moving stuff or scouting or moving munitions or moving food around or stealing from Americans and selling to the militants. There's just a whole group. There's a whole layer of handlers in the Afghan war that I think Ackerman captures really well. And I can only imagine how many houses of these guys he sat in trying to broker deals. You can really, really tell that, there's a particular kind of actor in this war that Ackerman wants to get to the bottom of. And Aziz is at these guys' mercy. And he really shows how he progresses from like a pretty average young man in a war-torn country to becoming, something approaching a hardcore militant himself. And one of the great strengths of the book is when you come to the end of it, even though Aziz is probably someone that would, do something pretty hideous to American soldiers if it came down to it, you don't really feel like he's a horrible, evil doer. You kind of understand the psychic journey he's gone through, and you don't really blame him for being the way he is. And that's really to his credit.
There is one, as you term it, sinister figure in the book, Mr. Jack. Who is he?
Mr. Jack is like a special forces guy who walks around speaking Pashto that he obviously is very proud of, but other Pashtos speakers in the book sort of, look at him cross-eyed. Ackerman says he sounds like a pretty knowledgeable Afghan toddler when he's speaking in Pashto.
Is Aziz a Pashtun?
I think he is, yeah. Yes, he is, because he's an adherent of the code of honor that Pashtun people have to repay murder with murder. And this guy, Mr. Jack, sort of is trying to keep a handle on various militants and various sort of middle-tier war managers, and thinks he's doing a pretty good job of it, and eventually he and Aziz have a reckoning with each other. And I think the Daily Reviewer, Chikoh Kakutani, sort of regarded Mr. Jack as kind of a caricature of a character. And I can totally see how she got there, but I thought he was an interesting person and the only American to be portrayed in such a dunderheaded way. I think you can sort of score some easy points as a writer doing that, but I also think he may have been a bit of an exorcism for Elliot Ackerman. I sort of saw Mr. Jack as some manifestation of Ackerman's own sort of frazzled confidence in trying to get a handle of the war as a soldier fighting there. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's how it felt like to me.
There's a great line in your review, which I will just read. When it comes to judging creative work, identity politics is the revenge of the intellect upon the imagination, the perfect lens for someone who knows everything about art accept what it's for. Obviously, the whole question of appropriation comes up with the novel. How good a job does Ackerman do in terms of inhabiting these Afghan characters? How well does it serve the novel?
Well, on one hand, he does it really well in that I believe in the daily details of the book. You know, I've not spent a tremendous amount of time in Afghanistan, but I have been there as a journalist during the war, and I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Uzbekistan, so I've spent a fair amount of time in that part of the world. And the daily details of lives and poor people's lives in particular in that part of the world, I felt were very convincing and rang very true to the books I'd read and the experiences I've had in Central Asia in particular. But the one part of the book that I call out in my review that I don't feel like he really did as deep a dive into was the sort of religious understanding of people like Aziz. You know, pretty extreme religious beliefs are normative in those cultures, and it would be very hard to find the gently questioning secular-minded people in that particular country at this particular time at that particular income and education level. And so while Aziz sort of speaks about, you know, going to a madrasa and stuff like that, he doesn't really have much of a religious perception or consciousness at all, and I couldn't really decide if that was just a can of worms Ackerman felt like he didn't even want to get into.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that was too potentially alienating to his audience, which I think is a legitimate enough reason not to get into it, or if he felt like if he really did want to create, you know, the one seemingly secular young Afghan militant like Aziz. You know, I didn't know. That was the one question mark I had as to how deeply he'd plunged into Aziz's mind. And that's a question I still have, but I'm still thinking about him as a character, so that should tell you that he did something right.
I'll just end with one other quote from your review. Elliot Ackerman has done something brave as a writer and even braver as a soldier. He has touched for real the culture and soul of his enemy. Is a pretty powerful statement, and as you say, will be interesting to see how the novel is received.
Very excited to see that myself.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Bissell reviews Green on Blue by Elliot Ackerman this week in the Book Review. Alexandra Alter is here with What's Going On in the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
We're going to talk about Kazuo Ishiguro.
Yes, he has a new book coming out next week. It's been a decade since his last novel, and this is one of the most anticipated literary novels of the year by far. What's interesting about it is I think it's going to be rather polarizing. It's a fantasy book. There's dragons, pixies, ogres. This is not what you expect from the author of Remains of the Day, and, you know, he's sort of known for his understated first-person style. This is a real stretch, and I actually got to meet him and interview him about the book, which he's sort of been mulling over for 15 years and really struggled with.
I love your opening anecdote. For those who didn't read your amazing profile last weekend, let's hear the story of what his wife said when she first read the book.
This was so funny. So he's famously reticent about showing his unfinished work to people. His editors don't see it, his agent doesn't see it, and usually his wife doesn't even see it. But if he's really sort of uncertain, he'll show her pages of what he's working on. So this was about 10 years ago that he showed her 50 pages of what became, you know, The Buried Giant, the novel that's coming out next week. And he was concerned about the fantasy elements and particularly the dialogue, because this book takes place 1,500 years ago in sort of a mystical Britain. And the way people speak, obviously, you know, how did they speak back then? So he was struggling with that. And he said he was expecting her to be, you know, a little critical like she often is, but encouraging. And she said, "You can't show this to anybody. This absolutely won't do. No one else can see this. This is a travesty and embarrassment." And so
don't ever show this to anyone.
And he said he was quite depressed after that. He put the book away for about 6 years. He wrote a collection of short stories and wasn't sure that he would ever finish it. But what he really struggled with, and this was very fascinating to me because you wouldn't know this if you just picked up the book, was he's came at it thematically. He really wanted to write about collective memory and how we deal with past atrocities as a society, or even memory in a marriage and how sort of shared memories really shape our relationships and our communities. And it was something that he was looking at telling through some contemporary or past historical episodes. For example, you know, France after the Nazi occupation, how did they deal with the fact that, you know, some people were collaborators and some people were part of the resistance, and how did they come together? Each society, each cultural and historical element that he looked at, he thought, well, if I write about that, no one's going to get the bigger theme. They're going to think it's, you know, he said it, this is going to look like a book about the disintegration of Yugoslavia. So,
right.
So he finally ended up with this, you know, very bizarre sort of fantasy world, which is a way for him to explore those issues, but without pegging it to any real historical event.
Many of his books deal with memory. And this fits in, I'm assuming.
Absolutely, yeah. I think you could say all of them do. It's an obsession of his, and he's actually quite, you know, worried about his own memory and his own sort of mental capacity as he's, you know, aging as an author. He said that he finds when he looks back on his life, there are certain things that he's absolutely sure happened that, you know, he'll look at the record of when he thinks it happened and it didn't. Of course, you know, his wife says he's got a perfect memory, and particularly when it comes to film, he's got this incredible visual, you know, memory in his head of things that happened. But
and two of his own books, of course, have been turned into quite incredible films.
That's right. Yeah,
Never
and this
Let
one
Me
is
Go,
optioned and by Scott Rudin and Sony as well. So there's a chance that this could make it into theaters. You're right. He's been obsessed with memory and sort of how memories fade and get distorted and suppressed, and how we really often can't face up to the past. And in all of his previous works, he's addressed this through an individual. They're always first-person narrators, and that's a very sort of sophisticated way to deal with that, because you can, you know, through the person's own experience, see what they're glossing over and things. But he really wanted to tackle it from a broader perspective and look at how communities and societies deal with memory. And so this is the first time he's really written in the third-person voice in a sustained way, and that was a challenge for him too.
And you flew to England to meet him. This was your first time meeting him?
This was the first time I met him. You know, I interviewed him in the past on the phone. He's extremely forthcoming about his process and how he, you know, works through problems as a writer. He still writes everything in longhand in his first draft, and he basically polishes it in chunks of 50 pages and then transcribes it to the computer. Usually doesn't show anyone unless it's his wife, who they've been together since before he was a writer. They met in 1979.
What was he before he was a writer?
He was attempting to be a singer-songwriter, and he was going around to these folk clubs and performing and sending his demo tapes to record companies and just getting rejected up and down. And he says that, you know, while he failed in that career choice, he really shaped him as a writer, because he went through all these phases that novelists often go through. He had his autobiographical coming-of-age phase as a songwriter. He had his purple prose, sort of Joycean, you know, linguistic pyrotechnic phase as a songwriter. And then by the time he got to writing fiction, he had sort of honed his style, which was very understated, very simple, often, you know, a lot of meaning packed in under the surface. So it's, you know, you have to sort of read between the lines with a lot of his work to sort of get at the emotion and what characters are really thinking and feeling. So
did he sing for you?
I wish he had. He didn't actually sing for me. He does have, he said, in his London house, he has 8 guitars that he plays regularly and a piano, and he writes song lyrics for a jazz singer. So he's still very much inclined towards music.
What was your favorite thing from your time with him that didn't make it into your story?
Oh, that's a great question.
The
cutting room floor. Well, you know, he lives in London, but he and his wife have this absolutely delightful miniature cottage in this medieval village in the English countryside. We walked around the village. We went into a bookshop. He's obsessed with these kind of obscure 20th century writers. So he was, you know, chatting with the bookstore owner about whether he'd picked up any more B. Traven or, you know, these books that he was looking for. And we, you know, took a walk in the countryside. And I was kind of pressing him because I thought, here's this medieval setting, even though the book takes place much earlier. It's sort of this, you know, there's all this fascinating English history here. And I said, you know, how did this shape, you know, the book, the landscape? He said, oh, no, I superimposed Iceland onto the British landscape. He really takes very little from his own experience. Like, that never makes it into his books. Even if he's writing a book about the English countryside, he's going to use Iceland as a model, because he said that was the kind of alien landscape that he wanted, something like a moonscape, something very wild. But that was fun. And we talked a lot about, he's a big movie buff, and he sort of binge watches in obscure genres. He's been watching a lot of screwball comedies lately. lately about a dozen of them, which are these 1930s romantic comedies. But he says they're, you know, they're really about the end of capitalism. He always reads between the lines, even in film.
So you added a few things to your Netflix list.
I certainly did. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
John Hooper joins us now from Rome to talk about his new book, The Italians. Hi, John.
Hi there.
So you are the Italy correspondent for The Economist, as well as the Southern Europe editor of The Guardian and The Observer. How long have you been based in Italy?
Altogether, it is, I'm trying to work it out now quickly in my brain, 16 or 17 years, because I lived in Italy during the 1990s, but I was based here and I was traveling out a lot to other parts of the Mediterranean. And then I came back in 2003, so it's been really a long time altogether.
Your book is called The Italians, not Italy, but The Italians. I'm assuming that's a very deliberate choice. Why did you call it The Italians?
Because I wanted to make it clear that this was a book about people and about the society, that it wasn't a book about politics or economics, though I do touch on both of those subjects as I go through the book. It's not a travel book either. It's not about places. It's very much about the Italians themselves and trying to get at what makes them tick, you know, why they are the way that they are, and trying to resolve some of the paradoxes that I and every foreigner who comes to live in Italy encounters.
I think that when Americans at least think about Italy, one of the first words that comes to mind is tradition. We think of this as a very traditional society, but Europe in so many ways is in flux. How does this play out in Italy and among the people? Is this a society that's in transition?
It is. It's very interesting that you should say what you've just said, because I think that that is a more accurate perception than the one that many Europeans have of Italy, which is they see the flashy sports cars, they see the cutting-edge fashion, and they tend to think of Italy as being an avant-garde and very modern society. Though that view is now changing, because people are becoming increasingly aware that Italy has not changed enough, that its economy has been stagnant really since the turn of the century. And in fact now, the standard measure of prosperity, which is GDP per head, is actually back at the level of 1998. So that shows you just how far Italians have fallen back compared to other people in Europe who've been making advances over that period. And this is, to a large extent, because of an unwillingness to change, an attachment to tradition. And it's the best and the worst of Italy. I mean, it's on the one hand the reason why Italians have such wonderful food, because they keep on refining a way of cooking it that maintains a respect for tradition and for the ingredients that they use. On the other hand, it means that they've been very slow to adapt many of the aspects of their society. Just one example is that Italians have been more reluctant than almost anybody else in Europe to use the internet and to use computers, though they have embraced some other technologies, for example, cell phones. They've taken to those very happily, partly because I think it conforms with an oral culture. But the internet and computers generally, no, and that has held back economic progress. There are many other examples that I could give of this, but society is in transition. I think it's because a new generation is coming up that is able to see that you've got a mixed tradition with modernity and progress.
One of the biggest changes, it seems, is demographic. A number of demographic changes, but one that's really striking, we tend to think, again, of Italy as being very family-centric with the, you know, in a Catholic country and huge families with this big central figure of the mother. But Italy is shrinking and aging, right? And how is this tendency towards one-child families affected the country?
You're right in what you say. The birth rate has fallen dramatically to the point that now the population is not replacing itself. It is technically a dying country without immigration. That's to say, more people are dying than are being born. And this reflects a number of different things. But primarily, I think the difficulty that Italian women have found in trying to play all the roles that are expected of them. So they're expected to be the carers of the older people in the family. They're meant to be wives and mothers and increasingly go out to work to earn the money that's necessary to keep the family in the situation to which it feels it's accustomed and to which it feels it's entitled.
How are women doing in Italy relative to other European countries, to France and Spain? Is there any progress in terms of women in the workplace and gender equality?
And the rate of women in the workplace is one of the lowest in Europe. So the answer is, your question is poorly, but there are signs of improvement lately. And indeed, I entitled the chapter on Italian women in the book, Le Italiane, Changing Attitudes, because I think that they are changing. After a long period in which they were stalled, there came a moment that actually coincided with the scandals over Silvio Berlusconi's sex life, the scandals over the then Italian Prime Minister's bunga bunga parties in which he invited lots of young women around to entertain him. This really had a big impact. There came a moment when you felt that Italian women were just saying, basta, this is humiliating and we're not going to have any more of it. And the politicians have reacted to that. And at the last election, there were many more candidates. And we now even have a government in which half the ministers are women. But having said that, I'm not sure how much deeper it's going to go, because politicians are one thing and society is another. And in many areas, women have been held back, and practices and attitudes persist in Italy that have died out elsewhere, including elsewhere in Latin Europe.
I know you said the book isn't primarily about politics, but since you brought up Berlusconi, I have to ask, because it's such a mystery, at least to me, how the Italian people could keep electing him, scandal after scandal after scandal. Is there something about the Italian population, or does it have to do with who votes in Italy?
I think there are several reasons for it. I mean, one of them is that he does have enormous media power, control of three television channels in a country where still a large proportion of the population, because they're not embracing the internet in the same way as in other countries, take their news from television. That's unquestionably very important. Berlusconi is a brilliant communicator. He uses a kind of simple language that Italians understand because it's the kind of Italian they hear in the street. He also gives an impression that he'll be pretty easy on people and let them do what they want, and that might even extend to not always paying their taxes. Though in fact, under his government, they actually rose. I think also he gave to people an image of the self-made man, which went down very well. In a society where social mobility is quite restricted, here was a man who'd made himself a billionaire, one of the richest people on earth, through his own ingenuity and perseverance. And I think that image was very, very important.
The other major demographic trend that we think about with Europe, in addition to aging, is, of course, immigration. How big an issue is immigration in Italy, and how is it? What makes immigration in Italy different from other countries? Where is the immigration coming from, and how well is Italy handling this influx of different cultures?
When I first came to Italy in 1994 to work, I found a country that was predominantly white. That is not true today. It has changed many aspects of society, and I think that one of the difficulties is that it's been so sudden that Italians have not had the time in which to change many of their attitudes, and that can exacerbate the situation because it means they don't have a sensitivity to racial issues that has been allowed to develop in other countries like Britain over a much longer period. One of the things that it's doing is to make the, for example, the pension system a bit more sustainable because it's bringing in more people of working age whose contributions to the social security, the welfare system, are allowing the non-working population to draw their pensions. And in many other ways, it's making a very positive contribution. For example, family bonds in Italy remain remarkably strong, despite the smaller families. And people are very reluctant to put the older members of their families into care homes, of senior citizens' homes. And what the Italians have done is to recruit modestly paid immigrants to fill the gap. And one of the sights that you frequently see on the streets of Italy is an elderly Italian walking along rather slowly on the arm of perhaps somebody from the Philippines or the Cape Verde Islands or Nigeria or wherever. These people are called the badanti, carers. When people talk resentfully about immigration, they need to bear that in mind. And in some areas of the country, they are also reluctant to talk negatively because Italians themselves were emigrants until relatively recently. Many went abroad in the late 50s, early 60s. There's almost no family in southern Italy which doesn't have some member somewhere who left the country.
We've been talking about very serious matters here, but there's a lot of fun in the book, and especially when you look at the table of contents, there are all these kind of intriguing little subtitles and titles you have, and I just want to touch on a couple of them. One chapter is called Gnocchi on Thursdays. What's that about?
Yeah, that's about tradition. Here in Rome, when you go into any eatery on a Thursday, however modest or however illustrious, you will almost certainly find that there are gnocchi on the menu, but only on a Thursday. If you hesitate to eat gnocchi that day, people look a bit disappointed. They look a bit let down because eating gnocchi on Thursdays is what you do, but almost nobody knows why. I've asked many Romans, and they have no clue. I found an old saying which suggests that people ate gnocchi, which are very filling, on a Thursday because they knew that the lean day in which they would eat fish or vegetables, Friday, was coming next. But nobody really knows, and it's just a tradition that exists because a tradition exists.
You also have a chapter, people who don't dance. Do Italians not dance?
They go to discos, yes. But one of the things that strikes me is that Italians do not spontaneously break into dance in the way that most Mediterranean people are capable of doing. You think about flamenco in Spain, dances that exist in Greece or in North Africa. I use that as an example of the lack of traditional dances that are anything but extremely structured in most parts of the country, as an example of reserve, because I think that one of the other paradoxes about Italians is that they are warm, extrovert, but not spontaneous. they're people who, by and large, there are obviously exceptions to this, but who are calculating the angles. They are making sure that before they speak, they have thought whatever it is through properly. And that's because in a society in which things are complicated, a society that has quite a high presence of organized crime, and for many other reasons, Italians need to hesitate. They need to be cautious. A book which bore the same title and was back in the 1960s, Luigi Barzini's The Italians, an excellent book. Some of it now is outdated. There's a wonderful passage there in which he talks about Italians going through life like scouts, testing the ground, looking for hidden traps. And I think that, if nothing else, is as true today as it was when it was written.
All right. Well, I feel like it is Thursday here as we're talking, and I feel like going and getting gnocchi now, premeditated gnocchi. John Hooper, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pablo.
The book, again, is The Italians. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
There are three new titles on the hardcover fiction list this week. Starting down at number 8, Laurie R. King has the next book in her series about Sherlock Holmes and Mary Russell, his wife. That book is called Dreaming Spies, new at number 8, and takes the couple to Japan. Then at number 7, Allison Pataki, the daughter of the former New York governor, George Pataki, has her second historical novel. It's called The Accidental Empress, and it is about the wife of the Austro-Hungarian emperor, Franz Joseph.
People able to read things into this about New York politics, or maybe not so much?
I don't know. Yeah, people did try to do that with her first book, which was called The Traitor's Wife, and it went back to Benedict Arnold. I think at this point, Allison Pataki has distinguished herself enough in her own career that, and George Pataki is maybe not as relevant to the national discussion anymore, so people aren't making those connections. Then finally, on the hardcover list this week, new at number 5, Richard Price, writing as Harry Brandt, has his new crime novel, The Whites, that is new at number 5.
And that was reviewed on our cover.
By Michael Connelly.
And then still at number 1 is The Girl on the Train.
Yeah, it is chugging along, you might say. it is
speeding along.
That it has become the breakout hit of the season.
All right. What's new on the nonfiction list?
Just two new titles on the nonfiction list this week. Down at number 11, the combat photojournalist Lindsay Addario, who was recently a guest on The Daily Show, has a memoir.
Something we won't be able to say for very much longer.
I know. Jon Stewart will not be making bestsellers for much longer. Her book is called It's What I Do, and it's a memoir describing what she does as a photojournalist in war zones. And then at number 8, another cover review for us, Helen MacDonald's memoir of grief and falconry, H is for Hawk, is new on the list at number 8.
Two new memoirs by women.
Yes.
All right, then. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.